If I bleed tonight, if I am sad tonight, I don't have a job to find. And if I work tonight, if I'm so tired tonight, I'll fall asleep when I'm home, when I'm home. Hey everybody, and welcome to a brand new episode of the Power Slam podcast here on Inside the Ropes. It is the 150th episode of the Power Slam podcast, and what we are doing to celebrate is we are staying in our house for the foreseeable future. My name is Kenny, and I'm here with Finn Martin. Finn, happy 150th episode.
Wow, it's another milestone, Kenny. I mean, who would have ever thought that we would have got to this number? Well, probably everyone, actually.
Although people say, what are you going to do to celebrate this milestone? Usually, as we always do, we forget about the milestones until it's too late to organise anything. So, but we're here. We're here to podcast. That's a celebratory thing to have.
And, I mean, it's not the third anniversary, because what would that be? 157, would it? 157? So we're some weeks off that yet.
We've got 6 weeks to decide on what we're going to do. Because the thing is, we can't even meet up in person and have a Jaeger bomb, because that's not allowed. You would be stopped at the border.
I mean, keep the lockdown going.
I did have to laugh that Ennis McVeigh had obviously put the Inside the Ropes Facebook community together, which you can join if you want some cool discussions on Facebook. And Liam Stewart had made this video of loads of people on the community kind of saying thank you. Finn was on there. And one of the people, I think it was Anthony Fitzpatrick, had said that his favourite moment of being in the Facebook community was seeing Finn having a Jaeger bomb in Glasgow when he was out his nut. And I think that's as good a reason as any to have a Facebook community, really.
Well, it is. What's the competition? If that's his favourite moment.
You know? Well, somebody else had said that their favourite was the moment that I didn't realise that I'd kind of spoiled the AJ Styles beat Jinder Mahal for the WWE title in Manchester.
That was funny. I mean, that is just a hell of a video that I can still... I mean, it's imprinted on memory. Your expression when the change takes place and you're quite literally jumping for joy. I mean, it was like being at Wembley Stadium for SummerSlam 1992 when Davey Boy Smith beat Bret Hart. I mean, that type of moment, that type of jubilation.
What can I say? Gender's loss just brought that out in me. But how are you coping, Finn? I think this is like we've now been in lockdown for about 2 months, I think it is, this week. Are you finding any new skills? Are you developing a beard? Is anything happening?
Hair's getting quite long. I thought it actually looked all right in the video I did of myself last week for the Inside Ups community. But now it looks terrible. So, I mean, I look pretty ridiculous at the moment. What else have we been doing? I mean, I painted the door on the garden, like the back gate. I painted that over the weekend. That looks really good. I'm not going to share that photo, don't worry. So I've just been getting on with, you know, loads of boring things, tunes on the guitar. But mostly, Kenny, watching wrestling.
Wrestling never stops.
It never stops. I mean, this is the thing about, you know, the fact that wrestling's still going during the lockdown. I think is, you know, it's really good for us as fans. So much was still to watch. So even though some of it is not as good as we would like it to be, I think a lot of them are making the best of a obviously bad situation. And there's still plenty of entertainment for us wrestling fans to watch and digest each week. And of course, if we don't like the modern stuff, we can always watch the old stuff. Tons of that out there as well. So, I've been catching up on my wrestling, nearly up to date on my Impact, still a little bit behind on AEW, pretty much up to date on NXT, Karrion Kross and Scarlett debut, which I thought was very impressive. I thought that entrance was a very impressive entrance with the dry ice and, you know, the spooky imagery on the video wall. That was very well done. You can see that he's going to be fast-tracked. He is going to be fast-tracked to the main roster. You know, at any moment in time, being fast-tracked to the main roster doesn't really mean much, unfortunately. But if we were under normal circumstances, I think I'll be very excited about Ross's inevitable migration to the main roster and his prospects there. But I thought that was I thought the staging was very well done. What did you think, Kenny, to that?
I thought the Scarlett and Karrion Kross entrance was really good. I hope they do just get put up to the main roster as soon as we get fans back, and because they're definitely a main roster act for sure.
Absolutely.
And I do want to say, just to, I know it's a sad note, but I feel like we should bring it up. Obviously, really tragic what's potentially happened to Shad Gaspard, former member of Crime Time, who was I think it was swimming, or he was in the water at a beach in the States with his son, and there was a riptide thing that happened, and he made the lifeguard save his son, and he's not been found. It's been a couple of days, and the signs are not very good that he will be recovered. But everybody that talks about him says he was a great guy. I thought he had a lot of potential in WWE back in the day. I know he moved into acting and stuff, but just a real shame that that's happened to him. So it sucks.
Absolutely does. Yeah, really sad. What more? Such a tragedy. Yeah,
for sure. But I do want to ask you a couple of things that I've been seeing happen on our Facebook community. I thought it would make for some good discussion on the podcast. So one of the things that I saw was on our Facebook community, I think it was Connor Hughes, a few people have been trying to come up with like wrestling Mount Rushmores, right? Of the wrestling Mount Rushmores, like of the heels, of baby faces, of nice guys, or whatever it would be, right? And the one that came up recently was a women's Mount Rushmore in pro wrestling, and I didn't put my idea of who I would put in there, but I wanted to bring a name up to see what you think. If we were sitting down doing our Mount Rushmore of women's wrestling, right? Of the whole gambit of women's wrestling, in my mind, one person that kind of kept crawling up was the Fabulous Moolah, just for the sort of notoriety and longevity that she had. But then there is the kind of the behind-the-scenes stuff and all the stuff that she, you know, came out that she had done and stuff, and she's kind of been, you know, not blackballed.
But she was absolutely terrible as a performer.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess my question was going to be to you, because I was thinking about Moolah, but then I was like, I don't really know if you could put it in, because there's so many connotations to that.
But goes on another Mount Rushmore, Kenny, but not that one.
Yeah, one with Chris Benoit. In terms of a women's Mount Rushmore, because the one that ended up getting the most votes from people on the Facebook community were, I think it was Trish, Chyna, Charlotte, and Lita. And just all kind of felt very modern. You know, it's just a very kind of modern list. The earliest it goes back to is 1997 with Chyna. I'm not asking you to do your full four, because I know it's maybe a thought process to do it, but like, is there somebody or one or two people from pre-Attitude Era that you think deserves a place on a women's Mount Rushmore if we're doing it?
No, I don't think so. The women's division was such a small part of the World Wrestling Federation really prior to now. I mean, obviously Wendy Richter seemed to be a big part, but she really wasn't. She got a lot of play, and she was obviously associated with Cyndi Lauper during the rock and wrestling era. But, you know, Wendy Richter was not a huge star during that period. So I don't think she really deserves it. And as far as Pratt, women didn't really play a very big part in Vince McMahon Jr. or Vince McMahon Sr.'s organization. So I wouldn't say so, really.
Can I throw in a name who I think is... I would potentially throw into the hat to be considered. Not for wrestling, but for in wrestling. And I think Sensational Sherry was incredible as a valet. So I think that she maybe deserves a nod if we've got Chyna in there. Because, you know, Chyna's not exactly going to be in there for her wrestling. Is Sherry a shout? Is she someone... Do you see her as a high-ranking person, even though it wasn't for wrestling?
Well, I mean, she was a wrestler, wasn't she? She did wrestle for the company.
The ladies' champion.
Yeah, during that period. But she certainly became a much bigger star as the manager or valet of Macho King Randy Savage. So, I mean, that was really her finest hour in the company. And she did have, I think, a run with Shawn Michaels was pretty good as well. But, I mean, certainly her stuff with Savage was you know, the pinnacle of her career in the WWF. But I mean, as far as she's not really renowned for her wrestling, even though she was a wrestler. But I mean, wrestling had been so downplayed by that point that they were rarely were women's matches on pay-per-view or even on TV. I mean, you go back and look at, you know, the Saturday night's main events. There wasn't that much female involvement back then. It was not seen as a priority. It was not seen as a ticket seller or a ratings grabber. Women's wrestling. It was more like this sort of filler part of the show. But I mean, when she was, you know, attached to the hit with Randy Savage after Savage turned heel, she became a pretty damn big star in that company. And she was somebody who knew what to do. She knew how to heal it up out there. She was basically willing to do almost anything. And that was the kind of shocking thing about her, and the bumps she would take. Kind of amazing, really, the stuff that she did. And I'm sure in later years she deeply regretted that because she ended up with a horrific back injury. But I mean, that was, you know, she was somebody who really saw that it was her job to go out there, be the heel, and then at the end of the match receive her comeuppance, whether it were from Hogan or whomever. But I mean, yeah, she was taking all sorts of bumps and getting thrown around. And, you know, during that era, you know, whenever she received her comeuppance from the babyface, it got a pop. Obviously, they wouldn't do anything like that now. But back then, she was seen as fair game. So just as, you know, if you move it forward a decade, Bubba Ray Dudley was putting female performers through tables or whatever. That was not seen as, even though it was kind of shocking, the whole framed by WWF in that, you know, kind of era when there was, you know, dubious morality, shall we say, Kenny, it was seen as something that was acceptable for a babyface to behave like that. And in fact, if you go back and look at the Dudley boys, him smashing women through table was kind of their transition from heels to baby faces, wasn't it? As crazy as that sounds.
It is mad to think that putting the innocent women through tables turned him into a babyface, but that was 2000.
Yeah, that was the way it was. But yeah, Sherry, absolutely, in terms of being a valet, but not for her in-ring work. I mean, she wasn't bad in the ring, but standards back then were nowhere near where they, you know, rose to in the 2000s. But you look at the standards in the last 10 years are so much better than they were in the 2000s. So it's been a constant evolution, really, for the female performers. But yeah, you go back and watch a Sherry match from WWF in, say, like 87, and chances are you won't be impressed by it. I've watched a few of them, and you really want to watch them twice. I mean, they weren't embarrassing or anything, but I mean, there wasn't really a whole lot of finesse there. And for me, Sherry was much better as a performer who was a valet, who would do all the heel stuff at ringside, and she was tremendously effective as that, effectively a heel manager.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I would throw her into the hat, because I mean, you know, if China's on there, I don't think China's in there for her in ring stuff. You know, China's in there for being the bodyguard, for being not that she, I mean, she was fine, but she's not in there for being a great women's wrestler.
No,
you know, she's in there for the different part that she played, but. Anyway.
I think with China, she was in her own right. I mean, I think it's, you know, debatable as to whether or not Sherry was. I mean, when Sherry was associated with Shawn Michaels or Randy Savage, star, but was she really a star on her own after that? And I don't think she really was. I think she needed to be linked with a star, you know, or an overact in order to seem like a star herself. So, I mean, I wouldn't put her on the Mount Rushmore, even though I'm, you know, I'm in awe of her talent. I mean, she was tremendous.
So also something else that has been talked about for the last kind of few days is we found out last Wednesday that Mike Tyson is going to be presenting the winner of the TNT Championship Tournament this weekend at Double or Nothing. He's going to be awarding the belt to the winner, Cody and Lance Archer. And it's kind of provoked this discussion of Mike Tyson, is it a good idea for AEW to bring him in? Should he be sort of... Is it okay to bring him in now, given some of his past transgressions that he had? Where do you fall on it? Do you think it's a good idea for AEW to have him involved, given obviously he's previously made a big dent when he's been involved in pro wrestling, or is this something they should have avoided? Where do you sit on it?
I mean, obviously it was in the 1990s when he went to prison, so it was very serious business what went on back then. People can look that up for themselves. Obviously, WWF used him very successfully in 1998, and you know, he's been in movies and he's been in a lot of TV programs, and he's done lots of things in the entertainment world over the last, what will it be, like 23 years or whatever it's been since he came out of prison. Maybe 24 years. I'm not exactly sure how many years it is since he's since his prison sentence ended. I don't know whether it really would be constructive for me to offer an opinion. I mean, I'm not going to knock AEW for doing this because WWF did it, and it worked very well for them. It was a big success for them. They weren't really criticised. I mean, sorry, Tyson wasn't really slammed that hard by the media back then, and WWF weren't either. Really, for what he'd done in you know, for the crime that he committed, the publicity back when that business relationship was announced in 1998, the opinion of the press, the general thrust of the press opinion on Tyson at that time was that he was lowering himself, he was demeaning himself, getting involved in pro wrestling, which was, when you think about it, was completely, I mean, totally skewed morality when you think about it, based on what he'd done previously. It's just like, why? Well, Tyson's lowering himself for getting involved in pro wrestling when he cannot box after it was the Evander Holyfield situation, wasn't it, where he bit Evander Holyfield's ears in 1997. Then he was banned from boxing. I think it was for a year. I think that's correct. So he needed the money. He was skint. You know, he'd blown all his money. And he needed, you know, when WWF came calling, and they paid him the millions, he accepted the offer. He'd been a wrestling fan as a child. I mean, he was obviously really, really enjoying himself when he did all the angles with DX and with Steve Austin. I mean, he was having a great time doing that. He needed the money. For him, it was a win-win. I mean, I don't think he cared at all what the press thought of him or thought of his decision getting involved in pro wrestling. So, I mean, I really feel like I don't really feel like I would be comfortable criticizing AEW for bringing this guy in. Already done. He's already been involved in pro wrestling, and that was quite soon after his prison sentence ended. So I don't know whether it's really going to be helpful for me to applaud or criticize AEW for doing this. They've obviously got the reasons for doing it, and those are to generate publicity, to make themselves known to people who aren't currently aware of All Elite Wrestling, and maybe generate some buzz, some mainstream buzz, and, you know, steer some more people in the direction of AEW, just as WWF did by hiring Tyson for that short run from January of 1998 through to March of 1998. So it seems to me like they're really looking for that sort of, you know, stardust. Pardon the pun, stardust with Cody Rhodes. they're looking for Tyson's star to elevate them in the general public consciousness. So I understand why they're doing it. I'm not going to argue with anyone who wants to condemn AEW for doing this. That's someone else's opinion. If they feel that way, then, you know, that's up to them. I don't really feel like it would be helpful for me to knock AEW for bringing him in. I understand why they're doing it. And now they've come to it. I hope it does pay off for them. What do you think, Kenny?
I'm kind of in the middle about it because I get that people are uncomfortable given his past. I do understand it. I also think that people should be able to get a second chance. I guess the decision is, do you feel that he has been apologetic enough for what he's done? I'll be honest, I've not seen enough interviews with him, or I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. But I think, I do find it interesting. I mean, I don't have a problem with them using him, but maybe if I had different things that had happened to me in my life, I would feel more problematic about it. What kind of fascinated me about the story was that in wrestling, there's some people who can kind of get away with anything that they've done, you know, whereas some other people just do not. And I think it's got to do with how you feel about a performer. Like, for example, if you look at Stone Cold Steve Austin, and I'm not knocking him here whatsoever, but like, Austin is very beloved, but he has also had two domestic abuse arrests in his life, and that doesn't really ever get brought up. And I think part of the reason is because if people love that Stone Cold Steve Austin character and they love the guy, they want to kind of forgive the person behind the character. They want to, they're willing, they're given the goodwill to kind of let it go and cheer the person on. But I think with Mike Tyson, for example, like, if you're a wrestling fan, you don't really like boxing, you've not really got many ties to Mike Tyson. So you've not really got anything that you're willing on for it to work more than you would if it was somebody you love, like a Steve Austin. So it's easier. You know, it's like if there's somebody who I don't know who is very homophobic, right, it's very easy for me to go, fuck that person, I'm not dealing with that. However, if it's somebody who I'm very good friends with who makes a very drunk comment and then we've got to kind of have a discussion about that, that's messier. And I, knowing the person, would probably want to try and work through it and try and, you know, find a good solution at the end of it, because I have investment in the person. I have investment in, like, that, you know, my relationship with them. So I think that fans have relationships with performers a lot of the time, and that can be, you know, why people will either, you know, Hogan was somebody who was from a very long time ago. So I think that, you know, in 2015 when his thing happened, he had not really been a relevant person for at least a decade, really. So young fans didn't have any sort of attachment to the Hulk Hogan character. So when they're seeing this kind of racist rant come out, it's very easy to kind of go, nah, I'm done. Fuck him. I'm not interested. And I totally understand that. But I think it is interesting how we kind of have this. Am I making any sense that there's a kind of relationship that fans can have with a performer? And I think how you feel about a performer can sometimes depend on how hard a line you might make on something.
Yeah, well, you know, we all often seek opinions to confirm our own, in essence, prejudices, don't we? Whether it's on politics or anything in life. You will often look for people who will tell us what we want to hear. And we obviously do make excuses for people and exceptions, and consciously and or subconsciously. We as human beings do that. You know, when it comes to Mike Tyson, I've seen quite a few pro wrestlers wearing Mike Tyson merchandise. And in fact, in The Undertaker, The Last Ride documentary in episode one, which we're going to be talking about in this podcast, when he's in the car, Undertaker's wearing an Iron Mike Mike Tyson t-shirt, isn't he? And I've seen, you know, various other wrestlers wearing Iron Mike. I wouldn't wear one of those, Kenny. Would you?
No, I don't think I would, but I don't think it would be a conscious decision. I just don't think I would have ever worn a Mike Tyson t-shirt. But I get what you mean. I mean, Cody's wore them, and Cody obviously is doing a lot of great things with AEW, with like the kind of, you know, the what's the thing called, the culture thing, where it's like people who've got, people who can't be in big groups, they're bringing in ways for those people to be able to go to wrestling shows and stuff, that they're being very inclusive. So it's weird to see people on all sides, like inclusive people, right leaning people, all, every type of person seems to kind of have forgiven the Mike Tyson the Mike Tyson thing, because he's built a brand for himself over the last 15 years of like, I'm not that guy anymore. I'm now this fun, I'm the guy from The Hangover. I'm the, you know, I'm the fun-loving Mike Tyson guy. So I think he's, I think there's been a conscious effort from his camp to try and turn his image around. And I think that it's worked on a sort of general level, but I think that when you get to, there definitely has been some blowback online with this announcement.
Oh, I can well believe there has been. I mean, whatever you do, there's going to be, you know, some people come. And with Mike Tyson, I mean, that they must have been aware that that would be, you know, that that situation was likely to develop. They've decided to do it anyway. But you're right. Yeah, some people have kind of been excused in the court of public opinion, and other people haven't, even if they've, you know, open, close quote, paid their debt to society by serving time or whatever their punishment was. So, I mean, all these things, Kenny, where people have got to decide for themselves, and, you know, people have got to decide whether they think it's right or not. And I'm a, you know, I'm a big believer in that, is that people have got to make up their own minds. And a situation like this, I don't think really someone can make up your mind for you. You have to decide whether you think this is acceptable or unacceptable. And as I say, I know why they're doing it. Some people will object, have a right to do so. And if it's something that, I mean, very much like WWE and, you know, doing business with the Saudis, lots of people have strong objections to that, as we have discussed many times before on this podcast. And we have said, well, listen, if this is something that you don't want to watch and you want to unsubscribe from the WWE network, as a result of WWE doing business with these people, then you have the right to do that. And you, you know, everyone's got a right to their own self-determination in our society, and you should do that. You know, your morality is yours to control, and, you know, don't let us tell you what to think. The Tyson thing, people have got to make it, make up their own minds about it. All I know is that I wouldn't wear Mike Tyson merchandise, Ken, much.
Well, there's your Christmas present this year, going to have to be sent back. You got a chance, though, Finn, to see the first episode of the Undertaker documentary series, The Last Ride. It focused on his match with Roman Reigns at WrestleMania 33. And we kind of get to see that he was not in any, in nowhere near the shape to be in that match at that point in time. It's kind of the story of him trying to get it together to go out there and do the match. We see the problems that the match had. We kind of see him at the end watching it back, just kind of embarrassed watching it. What did you make of the documentary? What do you make of, is it more understandable after watching that first episode why he did come back after that match? Because he felt he maybe couldn't leave it on that note?
Well, I mean, it is. It absolutely is. I mean, it was quite interesting. They rewound, didn't they, to 2014, WrestleMania 30. Undertaker Matt Cavill saying that he has no memories at all of the Lesnar match, and that the last thing he remembers of that day was being backstage at 3:30 p.m. Michelle McCool, his missus, said, you know, he was that badly concussed that I don't think he could actually say his name until, was it the following or something? It was quite a few hours later before he even knew his own name. That's how bad the concussion was. And we had, I mean, I remember hearing the story, Vince went to the hospital with him, and Brock Lesnar went to the hospital with him, and Vince left the rest of WrestleMania in the hands of Triple H, you know, which I think was a real sign from people of how highly that Calloway was valued by Vince McMahon. And you sort of hope that Vince would do that for somebody else as well, wouldn't you? In the, you know, he was saying in the episode that our first priority is the health of the performers. And you would hope that if it was a performer that wasn't the star of Undertaker's magnitude, you know, that Vince would do the same thing for that person. And it's not just because The Undertaker was a big star that he chose to go to hospital. But I mean, yeah, it was, so they set it up by talking about team match and the injury he'd suffered, and then they were talking about a lot of the other injuries he'd suffered, and then that led us into 2017 and the match with Roman Reigns at WrestleMania 33, and he was walking around backstage, and he knew, didn't he? He just knew. You could just tell before the match that he knew that this was not really a very good idea, but he'd committed himself to it, so it was happening. I mean, one of the moments that really moved me was when they had footage of him backstage just before the match with Bray Wyatt. It would have been at WrestleMania in 2015, and he's backstage with he's like kneeling down, and he's racked with self-doubt. He admits to this, you know, he's really nervous. He actually, what was quite I thought fascinating, it was Undertaker really conveying, you know, how you know, the magnitude of WrestleMania, that there'd always been some nerves. In fact, WrestleMania, he'd been at least a little bit nervous before he went out there, which I thought really communicated how much this show meant to him and means to WWE wrestlers in general. So I thought that was really, really quite moving, that statement that he made there. But he's backstage, and you know, Triple H recognized that something was wrong, and he went over and gave him a pep talk. But I mean, you know, the whole WrestleMania 30 thing with losing to Lesnar, you know, with the concussion and then the streak ending. I mean, to me, yeah, I've still never been able to understand why Vince made that decision. And I can understand as well why he would be questioning his, questioning his confidence level and questioning who he was before he went out to WrestleMania for the following year. I'm sure a lot of it was based upon, you know, am I having this match when the streak is over? I'm sure that was a big factor in it. And I remember thinking the same thing at that time. It's like, why is Undertaker having this match? Why is he even wrestling anymore? The streak's over. You've ruined it now. And he went out and had the match with Bray Wyatt, which meant nothing. So, I mean, you look at that and you think, you know, the whole him losing to Lesnar, I just thought was just one of the dumbest booking decisions they've made in the last 15 years, probably. But as for the Reigns match, yeah, you could see that he shouldn't have been in the ring. He knew that he was obviously in tremendous pain. He went and had the match anyway. And then, you know, at the end of the match, when Reigns scores the pin, Reigns, you can really kind of disappointed by the match. The Undertaker is as well. And then he goes backstage, but there's actually sign of like this sort of great relief, isn't there, when he gets backstage, and he's acting like it's over, you know, and he was saying that, you know, I'll be content to ride into the sunset now. And, you know, that whole thing of him leaving his gloves and his hat in the ring, we all thought his career was over, didn't we, after WrestleMania 33?
Yeah, and I think
and you it can... seemed backstage that that was where he was at. That was his intention, was that would be his final match.
Well, I think you could see when he was backstage that he kind of thought, right, okay, I've said this is it. I feel like shit. That's it. And I think you could see that when he watched it back. I mean, I remember having discussions with people who were saying, well, you know, he should just leave it there. And in my mind, I was like, that can't be it, you know, because as much as the people who kind of defend the WrestleMania 33 match talk about the symbolism at the end with the jacket and the hat and all that kind of stuff being laid down. And yeah, that is all well and good, but I don't really remember the symbolism as much as I remember how bad that match was. And, yeah, you know, like the Undertaker tombstone spot with Roman where he falls down, it's like, that's not what anybody who watched that character wanted to remember. So I think that as soon as he watched that back and he saw, you know, because, like, you know, sometimes you'll do something, like, whether we do a podcast or you in your mind you have an idea of how it went, roughly. Yeah. I think in his mind, it probably wasn't as good as it needed to be, but when he watched it back, he saw how bad it was. And then he had to come back and try and, you know, the second episode is titled Redemption. He needed to find redemption from that, and I get why, because if you work 30 years, your legacy is going to be the last thing that you do. It's just sadly the way it is. It's like, if Ric Flair's legacy had been the match he had at WrestleMania with Shawn Michaels, that would have been a perfect ending. But, you know, two years later, he was falling down a hole in the ring in TNA. Literally.
Yes, yeah, it was. That's right, absolutely. And, you know, his final match, September 2011 against Sting, was just, I mean, it was just awful. I mean, you don't even want to watch it. And it was that version that they screened, but it was pre-taped and was edited. They cleaned it up a bit and it was still that terrible. You know, he should have just quit. And he could have worked for TNA. They were paying him, I think it was $22,000 a month, at a time when they're paying many performers $300 per appearance, not per match, per show. So if you make multiple appearances, you get $300. And they were $2,000 a month. I mean, but he should not have entered the ring, Flair. He absolutely should not have entered the ring in TNA. But I mean, as far as Undertaker went, yeah, I mean, the match with Reigns, I mean, it's upsetting to watch how awful he looked in that match. And in a way, there's almost sort of maybe, you know, and this wasn't really brought up, and maybe it should be. Maybe there's an ass on his part, Kenny, that he felt that he was invincible and that he could go out and do these things that he clearly was incapable of doing. And you think, well, why attempt to do that tombstone reversal spot when you can hardly walk? And you think back and think, and I'm sure he's questioned it now, and I'm sure he's thought to himself, that was really dumb. Why did we do that? So, yeah, I mean, I enjoyed the first episode. It was far more candid than I imagined it would be. You know, he was talking about how, you know, each time he does a match at WrestleMania, that he's taking up a spot that, you know, strictly speaking, really belonged to a guy or a woman who's there working week in, week out, and that if he's going to be on the WrestleMania show, then he needs to earn it. You know, he needs to be good enough to deserve this spot and all this TV time and all this creative attention that's gone into whatever match he's going to have. And he was there saying, you know, he's mindful that he might be turning into a parody of his former self, and also told the story about last thing to be is that guy who's in the ring. And two people, you know, father and son are watching the match at home. And the father says to his son, "Oh, you should have seen this guy 10, 15 years ago. He really had it then, you know, don't be fooled. He used to be a somebody." And yet The Undertaker continues wrestling, Kenny. You know, so,
well, I thought one of the most interesting parts, you know, in episode two, they obviously focus on the John Cena match at WrestleMania 34. And, you know, the whole episode is him gearing up to train, and he feels like, he gets the hip replacement, the hip surgery, and he feels good, and he's training, he's going hard, and, you know, he does the match, and he comes back, and he's just really disappointed, and he says, "I trained for 45 minutes, and we went 5.
Didn't even last 5 minutes, did it?
Yeah, and there's a whole thing where you can tell that they've kind of lost faith that he's able to go out and do it. And he's trained in his mind to do, you know, to do a 30-minute match, and instead, and there's a disappointment he's got there. So, I mean, that's interesting. I mean, the next episode this Sunday, episode 3, is going to be focusing on the Crown Jewel match with Kane against DX and the Rusev match. But, you know, in the clip, they show you the clip of the tag match, and Undertaker says, I can't remember if he says it was garbage or we blew it. Something like that. But he understood how terrible it was. I'm fascinated to see how they cover this. And look, it's very difficult for me to watch these because it's like watching a nightmare play out on screen, because this is what I was going to be doing with them. But at the same time, I think this is the way it should be told. This is the way the story should happen. It should be on the network for everybody to watch, and not in a event in the UK where somebody maybe tried to get my camera phone or something. So I think it's good that it's happening, and I think episode 3 might be the most interesting one yet if we're actually going to get real discussion about that diabolical tag team match.
Yeah, and then presumably he'll be talking about the Goldberg match as well.
I assume that's going to be episode 4, and then episode 5 would be the Boneyard match.
Yeah, so I mean, at least it will end on a high.
And the question becomes, you know, because this whole thing is about, you know, the idea of redemption and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. And I mean, there's a lot of kind of touching moments in episode 2 with Vince. You know, there's a bit where the producer off camera says, you know, what does The Undertaker mean to WWE and mean to you? And Vince just gets really choked up and goes, nope, can't do that. Can't go there. You know, and there's something there with them that you can tell. It's very, very personal with them. And but when you get to episode 5, and I'm guessing, you know, we see the Boneyard match is a big success. Is he going to walk away? Or is he going to want it? Because the thing is, a 56-year-old, I think he'll be next year, 56, 55, whatever age he'll be, does he really want to go out in front of a stadium again? Or is that what he wants to go out on? He wants to prove that he can do it? I don't know, but... yeah, I feel like we could be in a cycle, though, Finn, for years of, like, he has a really great one, he has a really bad one. He has to get back to get a great one again, and it's just going to... Who's going to retire first? You or The Undertaker? I don't know.
I mean, well, probably me. But, I mean, I thought at the start of episode two when he's going in for the hip operation, and then he, after the operation, he's saying, well, it's great, the most of the pain's gone, and you can see it's been a success. And what Michelle McCool said I thought was very telling, where she was saying, well, I'm relieved that you're no longer in any pain, you know, on an hour-to-hour basis, but I'm concerned that, you know, what this might lead to. Because, you know, at the start of episode two, there's Michelle and Mark there watching. This is filmed in January of 2018, wasn't it? So it took him until then before he felt like he was actually prepared to watch the Reigns match from WrestleMania 33. So he sat there watching it and really upset by the performance, which you can understand. You know, because he said in episode one, last thing I want to do is, you know, let the business down, let the company down, let Vince down. I want to let myself down. This whole thing of, you know, performance, you know, entering the best performance possible is paramount. You know, there's no half measures with The Undertaker. So, you know, he then realizes that, you know, he knows after the match that the match has been very problematic. Then he watches it and all his worst fears are confirmed. He goes for the hip surgery. You know, is that just to sort of ease his daily pain? And Michelle McCool's been with him long enough to know at this point, oh no, what does this mean? Does this mean that he's going to make a comeback? And of course it does. But, you know, to go back to your earlier question, you know, when's he going to step off the ship? When's he going to call it quits? And I think he should go now. I mean, he had the Boneyard match. It was a cinematic presentation, was heavily edited. They used all the smoke and mirrors and all these other things. And to me, it was the perfect way for him to bow out. I mean, maybe he can do another match of that type, but certainly not a match in an arena. And I just feel like, you know, he needs to sort of accept that, you know, it's over and that this is the way to leave it. And that the more I wrestle, the more likely there is going to be another WrestleMania 33 or, you know, DX match style catastrophe or Goldberg match style catastrophe. Why take the risk when you don't need the money? It almost becomes like an arrogance thing where he's not accepting that it's over and he wants to continue, you know, because I don't know why, because maybe he doesn't want it to be over. But to me, if he's going to do, I would like him to retire now. He should have retired years ago, really. But I think the Boneyard match is a really very, you know, uplifting way to leave it. And the only thing I would endorse if he's going to do another match is another match of that type that can be pre-recorded and heavily edited. So if he wants to do another match like that, then, yeah, I think he can get away with it. But another match in arena, no way. Just don't do it. You know, and hopefully Vince McMahon will say, Mark, this is it. We're not doing any more matches now. We'll do this. We'll do one more of those. And then if it's a disaster, we can sort it out. We can clean it up in the editing suite and we can make it look presentable. And you can look like The Undertaker, but you're not having any. So I think Vince needs to really, you know, draw a line in the sand here and say, no, that's it now. And, you know, hopefully he will do, but I guess we'll see, Kenny.
The one other thing from episode two I thought was very powerful was after the match with Cena, you know, Undertaker makes a point to get up to Roman Reigns and saying, I feel bad about that match. I want you to know that. And you can see Roman Reigns is very kind of taken aback by it. Very taken aback that the Undertaker walks up to him and sort of says, you know, essentially, I messed up and I'm sorry. Yeah. And, you know, that takes a lot of guts to do that. Especially when you're someone who's like, you know, because he could have just been delusional and not done that. But the fact that he went up to Roman, I thought was a classy thing to do.
Well, you know, he's supposed to be the locker room leader. He's supposed to be the guy that sets the example. So, you know, he should have done that. He absolutely should have done that. If you're going to be the boss, you're going to be the leader. You're going to be the one who leads by example. Then you have to do things like that. So I'm glad he did that as well. But absolutely, he needed to do it.
And if there's anything from the Crown Jewel debacle episode of episode three, we'll talk about it next week, maybe. Oh, but so let's move on to SmackDown and Raw. So SmackDown was a pretty interesting show. I thought it had more life to it than usual. We kicked off the Intercontinental Championship tournament because Sami Zayn is being stripped of the belt. What do you make of this? I mean, obviously, Sami doesn't feel comfortable performing under the coronavirus, so they're stripping him of the belt. I mean, there's multiple ways to look at it. Does this mean that he's being punished? I mean, I took it more as just kind of, if he doesn't want to wrestle for the sort of foreseeable future, just do a tournament for the belt, and then when he comes back, he can face whoever's the champion. Maybe he can do like a Shawn Razor thing that they did in 93-94. What do you make of them taking the belt off Sami, though?
Well, you mean no full outrage, Kenny? That's what we need. We need more fake outrage.
Well, I did. My favourite thing that I saw was it, because Sami Zayn was hamming it up on Twitter, right? And of course he is, because he's a heel.
Yes.
And there's one bit where it was like,
I'm still the champion.
Yeah, well, he's doing all that stuff. But then, like, I think it was Fox had put, WWE on Fox had put this tweet out, and they said, the new Intercontinental Champion should be, and it's like blanks to fill in the name of who you think it should be. And it's like, the new Intercontinental Champion should be, and then Sami Zayn just replied going, ashamed of themselves. Which I thought was great. But we did get two qualifiers on the show. We got Elias versus Baron Corbin with
Elias. Oh, I don't think I answered your question, Kenny. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, if he doesn't want to wrestle, that is his judgment. That's his call. He's made that decision. I think WWE just wants the title back in circulation. I think it's fair enough.
Yeah, and I don't think he's being punished for it. You know, you've got to assume that he's probably being paid as he normally is to stay at home, because that's, you know, he's that's his call, and they're fine with it, but they're just going to get the belt back on TV.
Absolutely, I understand that. And yeah, I'm sure he does as well, and he's just playing along here. And when he finally does return, no doubt he'll be pitted against the Intercontinental Champion, and we'll have a storyline ready and waiting for whomever is the champion at that point.
So we got Elias defeating Baron Corbin to advance in a match that went 16 minutes, which meant it went about 13 minutes too long. It was like, I remember what one, a film that bored me to tears was No Country for Old Men. I was just so bored by that movie, and I felt like it was never going to end, and I felt like Elias and Baron Corbin brought me back to that moment in time in my life. But and then
I remember that being a pretty damn amazing movie.
Oh God, it was so long, Finn. It was so, it reminded me of like The Revenant with fucking Leonardo DiCaprio.
That was pretty good as well. It's Kenny, you know, it's just you just don't have any attention span. That's your problem.
I remember reading that Leonardo DiCaprio had spent 8 months in a fucking Eskimo hut to do The Revenant. And I was going, why?
Well,
8 months of your life for that?
He was there trying to impress the Academy. I mean, did it work, Kenny?
No.
Well, I thought he actually won the Academy Award that year.
He didn't impress me. And that's all that matters.
That's the main thing. Yeah.
Who read out the award? Warren Beatty? I don't know. Anyway.
What a bum.
But also we had Daniel Bryan defeating Drew Gulak. We'll talk about Gulak in a second, but Bryan defeating Gulak by submission in a very good match, and Elias beating Baron Corbin in the longest match I've ever seen in my life. What do you make of these two matches and the IC title tournament?
Oh, I mean, Corbin versus Elias. I mean, in a way, Elias needed retribution. Well, actually, kind of had his retribution at Money in the Bank, didn't he? So he'd taken that, you know, horrific beating backstage from Corbin on SmackDown. Then he kind of had his revenge at Money in the Bank when he appeared from out of nowhere. What was he doing at WWE HQ? Appeared from out of nowhere. Wasn't observing social distancing. How did he get there, Kenny? You know, that's what I want to know. So, I mean, was it that essential work? I mean, could he not have, like, you know, anyway, so Elias turns up, hits Corbin with a guitar and Money in the Bank, prevents Corbin from winning the Money in the Bank case. So has Elias really got full revenge for that beating? I don't know. So we're going to lead to Corbin versus Elias. Now, I thought Corbin was going to win this match simply because he'd previously been announced as an opponent for Drew McIntyre on the following episode of Raw. So I thought, oh, Corbin's going to sure. So then he lost to Elias. I mean, you know, a second match guy for life. And then he wrestles Drew McIntyre in event of Raw. I mean, this week's number for Raw, it's not going to be pretty, is it? It just isn't going to be. That third hour is going to tank because it's Corbin versus Drew McIntyre. So, I mean, who could possibly imagine that Corbin was a worthy opponent for Drew after he'd just been beaten by Elias. So, I mean, the match went too long. The booking made no sense to me at all. I mean, as for Drew versus Daniel Bryan, I enjoyed that match. I thought technically it was very well done. I thought Bryan's speech afterwards, you know, vowing to win the tournament and the title, was heartfelt. I could believe that him winning the title is very important to him, which is, you know, an emotion that I don't really feel that often when I'm watching pro wrestling, particularly WWE. You know, there doesn't seem to be that much in the way of genuine emotion in this company. But I thought Bryan really brought it after the match, and then Bryan and Gulak shook hands. So that was nice to see. So, yeah, I mean, the first match was, you know, interminable. But the second match, I think, you know, was I enjoyed it. And I'm glad that Bryan won. And I hope he at least goes through to the final of this tournament. I'd like to see him win the belt, actually.
Yeah, I think he's a great call to win it. Also surprising to see Drew Gulak, his contract expired with WWE, and apparently there was discussion that he'd been offered people had got a raise previously. He wanted a raise. When he asked for a raise, they said no. So as of now, he's gone. But you know, maybe they'll work something out. Maybe he'll end up in AEW as the mystery entrant of the ladder match on Saturday. Who knows? But Gulak's great. I think he's a really great talent, and he's funny. He can be serious. He's not someone I would let go.
No, I find his decision to leave at this time to be a bit strange. It becomes
apparently the story is that his contract offer was then rescinded after he asked for more money. So I think he then wasn't really given an option. It was a case of if you want a raise, we're not prepared to offer you that. Best of luck. But that, you know, what we could be watching, kind of, or speculating about is negotiations taking place. You know, maybe he's back by Friday. You never know.
Well, I mean, it happened. And what I was going to say was that Drew's really in about pretty much the best position he's ever been in this company. You know, I mean, he was laboring in anonymity on 205 Live. And I know he had his fans, people, I mean, and he was, you know, entertaining there, but 205 Live's, you know, like the D team, isn't it? If not the E team in WWE. So, I mean, it's just like, here he is on the main roster, he's associated with Daniel Bryan. You've got all sorts of different directions that you could go in here. It does seem like a strange time for him to leave, especially when we don't know when wrestling will resume, as we've discussed previously, because obviously no one really knows what's going to happen when it comes to people attending live events, you know, in America or in the UK and many other countries as well. So it's, it does seem like a strange time for him to quit. But I mean, maybe he's in a good position financially, and maybe it's a self-respect thing. Maybe, you know, looking at it from Drew's point of view, he's probably thinking, well, hold on a minute. You know, I've been working diligently for this company. I've been, you know, I've never been phoning it in. I've been really improving as a performer in the ring and out of the ring. I feel like I've become a valued member of this roster. We know that WWE is not short of cash. As they, you know, declared in their last quarterly earnings report. So, I mean, they could absolutely afford to give him a pay rise. Maybe he's thinking, well, if I don't ask for it now, when I'm actually important to this company, you know, and I've actually got a role on the main roster that matters, when am I going to ask for that pay rise? So, and then when the pay rise doesn't come, he's thinking, well, I'm not going to back down. Maybe the offer's rescinded, or maybe he's just thinking, well, you know what, I'm not. If you don't think I'm worth that, then that tells me what you think. So I'm going to ply my trade elsewhere. So I do understand why he's done it, purely from a financial point of view. And if he's in a good position financially, which I hope he is, maybe he can afford to do this. And maybe he thinks that his price tag or will go up when he's not there. I don't know. I mean, everyone's got to make their own decisions based on, you know, I think he's right. But I mean, you know, if you look at it, without thinking at it too deeply, it does seem like a strange time for him to leave, you know, when he's the most relevant he's ever been in his old time with this company.
It's also on SmackDown, though, I thought what was a very hot segment was Charlotte's return to SmackDown and her discussion with Bayley and Sasha. when she was kind of, you know, stirring the pot with Bailey and Sasha, but she was talking about, you know, she's all the stuff that she's done. And I thought the kind of old, the fact they've got all this history as part of the Four Horsewomen and some of that was brought in really made for a good segment. It's going to lead to Charlotte and Bailey this coming Friday on SmackDown, the champion versus champion match, you know, and even, you know, Charlotte talking about Sasha and, you know, now she's Bailey's lackey and all this kind of stuff. I thought it was really clever. I was into it. What did you make of the segment?
Yeah, it was advancing the storyline, that, you know, the slow burn storyline that we've been championing, Kenny, haven't we? We've been putting this over. You know, even though Kenny only has a short attention span, when it comes to this storyline, he's looking at the long game. You know, thanks to my direction, of course.
Of course, that only your direction.
Thanks to my mentoring and teaching and, you know, yeah, you're a good scholar, Kenny. You know, you're getting there. So, I mean, I enjoyed this segment as well. I mean, yeah, it's, as you said, that Charlotte said to Sasha, you know, we main evented the first Raw together. We main evented the first pay-per-views together. You're a six-time women's champion, a future WWE Hall of Famer. The boss, the blueprint, the standard. And you're telling me that you're content in Bailey's corner? That you're content being an afterthought? So, I mean, yeah, Bailey's there, you know, she's getting, you know, beads of sweat forming on her brow. You know, she's like trying to divert attention from what Charlotte's saying to Sasha. She's trying to skirt the issue. She's saying, oh, I'm not here to talk. I'm here. You know, and Sasha's there. It's as if, you know, she's like once again trying to fight off this resentment, you know, and stand by her pal. But I mean, yeah, this is all part of that long-term storyline with Sasha and Bailey doing the big split. And it's, you know, it's just a shame that there aren't ones present to provide an atmosphere for this storyline and all these reactions. And I think that would really enhance it more. But I think they're all doing a really good job under the, you know, no fan circumstances. I thought they're all communicating everything, all the emotions and sentiments that they're supposed to. And I think you know, Bailey, I think, has really come alive in this storyline. I think she's really stepped up, and I think she's really recognised that she needs to put more, you know, oomph and, you know, welly into her performances. And I think she's really rising to the occasion as, you know, this heel who's, you know, can see that everything's really precarious, but she's just trying to keep things as they are and maintain the status quo. But she kind of knows where it's all going. But, you know, and each time somebody brings it up, it you know, pushes Sasha ever closer to the point of saying, hey, you know, where's my title shot? You know, I've had enough, you know, being your, being, you know, Robin to your Batman, you know, and attacking her or something like that. So, I mean, that's where it's all heading. I think they're doing a really good job with it.
Yeah, and I think the big champion versus champion match with Charlotte and Bailey feels like a big match this Friday. So, you know,
it does. I mean, obviously, there's not going to be a finish, but I mean, it's, you know, there's going to be, Sasha's going to be involved in the ending. There's going to be, you know, more discord between Sasha and Bailey. And, you know, when do you see this split occurring? Do you think they're going to be able to spin it out till SummerSlam?
To me, SummerSlam's when it's going to be, right? I feel like, because I think Backlash of the June pay-per-view and Extreme Rules of the July one, so I'd imagine that we'll see the real cracks of it happen in July, and maybe, you know, maybe at that pay-per-view or the SmackDown after, that's when it all happens, and then it's the road to SummerSlam.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, you know, I know that some people are very concerned at the idea of them having fans for SummerSlam, but if they are able to do it, I mean, I just think that Sasha and Bailey by that point could really steal the show, because if this story's continuing to build and build and build, and it's been given the time, and it's being allowed to play out, you know, just with no interruptions, then I think they could have a really good, it's not going to be NXT TakeOver Brooklyn, but I think that they could do something special. So I hope that they exercise their due diligence, Finn, and keep to the plan.
Yes, I do as well. I mean, it doesn't feel like they're panicking when it comes to these type of things. You know, they know where they're going with it. I think everyone's on board with it. I mean, a lot of it's, you know, it's not over the top. You know, Banks is there looking glum, but she's not overacting. You know, it's kind of understated. And so I think she's, you know, Sasha, I think, is somebody, this is some of her best work in a long time, because she's not overacting. She's not hamming it up. It's very kind of which is what her part, you know, this story at the moment demands that reaction from her. And, you know, a month and a half from now, that'll be the time for her to start, you know, amping it up and overacting. Perhaps not overreacting, but reacting more. So, I think they're going to be able to keep this going until SummerSlam, and I think that's where the big match will be. And, yeah, if there are fans present, I mean, I've no idea if there will be in August, but if there are, I'm with you. I think this could be one of the biggest matches of the night because they've done such a good job of setting it up with this storyline, and all the players have done such a good job, you know, doing what they're supposed to do to build this storyline into a real winner. You know, for so long we've said, oh, WWE can't do long-term storylines anymore, it can't plan. And it's proven quite the opposite here.
Yeah, for sure. And the last thing I want to ask you about on SmackDown is we obviously saw Otis as a big character on SmackDown. He was on Miz TV to open the show. It leads to them wanting to take on Otis and a partner of his choosing. He's talking to Mandy about, you know, getting a partner. He tries to convince Sheamus, which just cracked me up. And then he finally gets Braun Strowman, and they've got a kind of fun interaction about, you know, what is his reasoning behind wanting to be in the ring with Braun Strowman, and that's the main event that we get. We end up getting Braun Strowman and Otis against Miz and Morrison in the main event. How did they do here with Otis? Did they present him in a way that you think was a good follow up to him winning Money in the Bank? How did they do just from sort of throughout the show and the way they tried to place him as a performer?
I mean, because he's effectively a comedy character, and they really emphasized the comedy aspect in the opening segment, didn't they? Where Otis was out there with Morrison and Miz doing effectively This Is Your Life segment on Otis, showing all these photos of him as a baby and as a young child. Otis claimed that he weighed 12 pounds when he was born. Yeah, I wonder if that's true. Yeah, so...
God, I mean, that mother would have needed a severe medical attention.
So, you know, Miz is there complaining about Otis, you know, and that he's an insult to the briefcase. You know, Miz is there, you know, when he was Money in the Bank champion. You know, this is what he said. Miz said to Otis, I can't take you seriously. You're Mr. Money in the Bank. When I was Mr. Money in the Bank, I used it as a platform to launch me into superstardom. You're using the Money in the Bank briefcase as a lunchbox. So he's saying that, you know, he's got his sannies in there and a packet of crisps or whatever it was. So, I mean, Otis to me, I mean, it's really hard to take him seriously in this role. He's acting even stranger than usual in the opening segment. It's not like he's transitioning into a serious performer. In fact, you know, quite the reverse. It seems like he's really hamming it up even more to be even more ridiculous. I mean, you can understand why Vince is amused by Otis. Because, you know, this to Vince is what pro wrestling is. It's just silly and ridiculous, people being over the top. So, I mean, you can understand why Otis has been given this slot. You know, he's there. You know, Vince obviously likes, you know, wobbling the belly around. You know, that's something that Vince, I'm sure, finds hilarious. I mean, he does all the thrusting, which I'm sure Vince thinks is the funniest thing as well. So, so Mandy Rose has suggested to Otis that he should team with Braun Strowman. And then Otis asked Braun, and Braun said he'd think about it. And then, as you say, in the end, Braun Strowman did decide to team with Otis. Strowman and Otis beat Miz and Morrison fairly easily. Braun used the power slam on Morrison for the pin. And then afterwards, Mandy came out, distracted Strowman, and Otis kind of intimates that he's going to try and attack Strowman from behind and cash in. So they kind of planted that seed in our minds that is Otis going to cash in on Braun, which, you know, presumably he will do because they're on the same brand. But, I mean, that didn't really go anywhere, and Otis kind of hammed it up and, you know, he did the comedic thing of, like, oh, I'm, you know, just kidding, and then they sort of bump fists, and that was it. So it was, I thought it was kind of a bit of a flat finish to the show, if I'm honest, Kenny. I was hoping for some sort of appearance from Bray Wyatt at some point in all of this. But I guess the focus was on Otis and Braun Strowman and making us think Otis could cash in at any time on Braun. You know, and might Otis actually become champion? I mean, it's hard for me to believe that he will become champ. again, Jinder Mahal became champ, and I never thought that would happen either.
I think that the Otis thing either works for people or the presentation works for people based on how into the Otis character you are. Like, I get a big kick out of him. I think he's really funny. So it kind of works for me, and I'm more of a fan of them doing stuff like this than burning through everything during the kind of empty arena era. Like, yeah. I like that there's a kind of side story where there's somebody who's not, you know, maybe look, I'm not saying Otis is going to be a main eventer, but like, if he has this run and he has the briefcase, that maybe means that he can be in a spot where when you need someone to fill in as a babyface in a main event somewhere, he can do it, you know, because he's had this run. So I like what they're doing. They're doing something different. They're mixing it up a little bit, but I know what you mean. You know, part of you just wants to see the Fiend and see what he's going to do. But I have a feeling we're getting there, and probably we'll get there this week on SmackDown.
This week on SmackDown, it's Otis and Mandy versus Dolph and Sonya, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. So I feel like Braun's going to be back to the Fiend this week.
I mean, Sonya caught a fairly packed, didn't she, on Mandy Rose?
She's doing great work right now. Sonya Deville, she kind of like Sasha and Bayley. They know the storyline. They believe in it. They're executing it very, very well. And I'm kind of happy to see, you know, on Raw and SmackDown, the women are kind of killing it right now. The women are really stepping up on both shows to try and you know, make these empty arena shows entertaining, and they are some of my favourite segments on the show, so props to them.
Absolutely. I mean, I thought Sonya there, she was saying, she predicted that Mandy would end up in a double-wide trailer with Otis and a bunch of kids. Mandy would be there cooking up some high-calorie macaroni cheese as they both expanded into their joggers. I mean, elastic
sounds like a great night to me, Finn.
Elastic waistbands, Kenny, they're the enemy, particularly in lockdown. Just say no to elastic waistbands. But yeah, I thought it was pretty Sonya imagining the future of Mandy and Otis living in a double wide trailer. Although that did amuse me.
Let that sink in. Well, let's move over to Raw. So Raw as well, it was a pretty packed show. But I want to ask you, Finn, because of the opening segment, we had Edge and Randy Orton with Edge accepting the challenge. And now it is on, Finn, at Backlash, the greatest wrestling match ever will take place between Edge and Randy Orton. Now, I don't want to cast aspersions here because it's not happened. So, you know, we're not people who are going to shit on something before we get it. But do you think that they're maybe over-egging the advertising here by calling this the greatest wrestling match ever at Backlash?
I just don't understand it. I mean, to me, heightened expectations, particularly in the current environment, are going to possibly lead to disappointment. And does disappointment lead to increased interest or increased revenue? It's a big fat no on both counts. So I don't understand this marketing campaign. Let's just say, right, Kenny, that they do have the greatest match in the history of the business.
Okay.
Because there won't be any fans present to watch it and provide an atmosphere, it won't feel like the greatest match in the history of the business. So even if they were to have that match, which they're not going to, it would still be seen as a disappointment because there's going to be no fans there to provide the atmosphere, which really every sort of great match needs. I wouldn't say every good match, but certainly pretty much every great match needs. I thought Charlotte and Rhea Ripley actually did a really good job at WrestleMania without the crowd, as we discussed at the time. But I mean, there's been very few matches in this era with no fans present that you would say, you know what, that was absolutely tremendous. I can't wait to watch that again. Very few.
I really wish there was a crowd for the Edge and Randy Orton stuff because they really, you know, they did really well in that build up for the match at WrestleMania. I know the match at WrestleMania was not everybody's favorite. I liked it, but I take everybody's point that it was too long. Yeah. But yeah, it just feels like this is. I think the Edge is here to tell really good stories, and I feel like that's what he's intending to do. I think that he is one of the people that is going to suffer the most through not having a crowd, because yeah. Edge is someone who is so beloved and is feeds off the crowd so much that you know, I think that they're gonna have a tough job on their hands at Backlash. But you know, look, I'm open to seeing it. Maybe I still, to now, even though we're like what 8 days afterwards, I still love when Orton challenged him to a wrestling match, and Charlie Caruso, with an attempt at sincerity, said, "Well, you know, that's probably going to be the greatest wrestling match ever." Oh God!
Oh, I don't know. I mean, you know, I mean, which do you think Charlie was most convinced about? A comments about Blackpool or comments about this match?
Blackpool, all the way. We also had, we'll race through the Raw stuff here. We got Murphy defeating Humberto Carrillo. Seth Rollins cut this. I can't find a word to describe how dull his promo was. It was so tedious. He just banged on, and it just didn't work. I love his look. I love the look, you know, the one glove and the suit, and he looks sharp. But, he was talking so slow. And I'm going, this is empty arena, Seth. You need to speed it up. Make us feel more energized.
Has he explained yet why he's wearing the glove?
No, I think it's just supposed to be ambiguous.
All right, okay. So he's there in his black suit with the black glove on it. You know, kind of, maybe it's kind of based on, maybe he's watched the, Doctor Strangelove, you know, the Peter Sellers character there with the glove on.
I thought it was more supposed to be like he's a hitman in a movie, and they have like the one glove with the gun and stuff. But obviously he can't have a gun. Ironic that he's in America and he can't have a gun on the show. But the other thing I wanted to ask you about on Raw though was we had Charlotte Flair come out to a promo about the match that she's going to be having on SmackDown with Bayley, and then she had a match with Ruby Riott, and I just kind of after this was going. I mean, obviously they're building Charlotte to something, right? They're building her to some big match. But I felt like the ease with which she beat Ruby Riott kind of bothered me. And I feel like if she's going to go through all these women, I don't have a problem with it if she's going to beat these women. But like after this, Ruby Riott just looked like an absolute jobber. You know, she there was no heat to the match. There was no, when Charlotte put the figure eight onto Ruby Riott, she just lay there and let her do it. And it didn't feel like she was in any way sort of in enough pain for that to take place. So this one kind of, the Liv Morgan one I liked more. This one I didn't really like as much. What did you make of the match?
Yeah, I'm with you there. And again, Ruby Riott is coming off those losses to Liv Morgan. So, I mean, that's baked in, isn't it? The knowledge that she's just lost to Liv Morgan and now she's doing the job to Charlotte in a match that just didn't matter. It came from out of nowhere. It wasn't set up with any sort of promos or any sort of real purpose other than to give Charlotte a win. I think they could have done a lot more with it than they did do. I mean, Riott is very much on the outs at the moment. She's certainly not a priority. She's there to put people over, which, you know, that's not when you've got a reason to put people over or if it's taking you as a performer somewhere. But Ruby Riott's just heading straight out the door, as far as I can see, in the next round of cuts based on her current profile and her current, importance to to Raw and to WWE. So I didn't get it all. There's a lot of things about WWE Raw. Where you think, well, why aren't these simple little things happening? You know, why isn't more effort and imagination and attention just being put into this match? Why aren't this team of writers and all these people coming up with something, particularly Paul Heyman, you know, the super booker extraordinaire, isn't he coming up with something here to give us a reason to care about this match? I did find it very strange. I think, Ruby Riott, she hasn't been back that long, and all she's done is jobs since she's returned, pretty much. Certainly, she hasn't won any feuds. You know, she's been on the losing end of everything in the climactic match, hasn't she, Kenny?
Yeah, it's. I think the thing with Charlotte is Charlotte's obviously going towards this main storyline where she's, there's nothing to worry about with Charlotte. She's getting everything. I just felt like coming out of this, I mean, even Liv Morgan last week, Liv Morgan came out, I felt like came out with a little bit of oomph from facing Charlotte because you were kind of like, okay, I could see them revisiting that. Liv Morgan had a promo earlier on this show basically saying that she's, determined and she's not going to give up. Ruby Riott here, this kind of felt like a, we don't have any real faith in you as a performer to give you any story, so we're just going to kind of throw you out there and job you out. You know, that just gives, yeah. It doesn't feel like they've got anything in mind for her. which is a shame because I know that a lot of people are behind her and she is a decent performer. So yeah, it just sucks.
Yeah, I mean, she really is. She's somebody that I was never really that impressed with her, but she's somebody who has really become a real all-round pro. And I think she's really, when she's in the ring, you have total confidence in her performance. And there's not that many, there's a lot of performers you could say that you don't have that about. That's a polite way of putting it, isn't it? That's a nice way of putting it, Kenny. But with Ruby Riott, yeah, she's better than this, Kenny.
She is. She's definitely better than this. Up next in the show, though, I want to talk about, so good, Asuka's celebration with Kairi Sane of being the new Raw Women's Champion. Kairi's bringing her out. She's showing all the belts that she's won on the big screen. And then Kairi Sane pulls out a recorder and plays Asuka's theme tune on it until interrupted by Nia Jax. And Nia Jax tries to be the big bully at the schoolyard when she says, you know, Becky's on maternity leave. You're just like a temporary champion, you'll be replaced soon. And then Asuka doesn't take any shit from her, just starts knocking kicks to her, does the hip attack and yells in Japanese. Asuka, I thought here, was just came across and was presented like a real champion. I love the presentation of Asuka here. And Kairi Sane, are you proud of, I mean, you're a musician, Finn, you play the guitar. How would you rate Kairi Sane's musical performance?
Well, I had no idea that Kairi was playing Asuka's theme tune.
Really?
that's my review. I mean, that's kind of like me on the guitar. I have to tell people what I'm playing.
Look,
so
you
know, Kairi and I share a bond of being fairly useless at musical instruments. But I thought it was really funny. I thought the balloon towers in the ring for the championship celebration, that really amused me. I thought, you know, the Kairi with the recorder, I think this has got a lot of mileage. I mean, this is going to be, you know, never mind the, you know, the pirate stuff that she had when she was NXT. You know, this is going to be her prop. This is what's going to get her over. Next thing, they'll be selling Kairi record. You know, mark my words, Kenny.
I'll buy one. Listen, just get them on sale. I'm happily take one off your hands.
So they're in the ring. Yeah, Jax came out. She gate-crashed the segment. You know, started being obnoxious to her. Asuka, telling her that she was undeserving. You know, Asuka wasn't taking it. Pounded Jaxie, sent her from the ring. That was it. She was out of there. You know, but the story continued throughout the show, didn't it, Kenny? Do you want to continue telling us the other things that happened in relation to these characters?
Yeah, so we later on, they were still celebrating, and Nia Jax ended up going after Kairi Sane. She whacked her off of one of the, you know, units that they keep all the equipment in. And then later after that, of course, Nia Jax was still trying to get to... because Asuka was with Kairi Sane, a trainer, and then Nia Jax was there. Asuka got in her face. Nia goes to walk away, and Asuka just kicked her in the head and yelled at her and walked away.
Damn good kicking. Jax fell down. Pow! Hits the floor. Looks like we're going to have Nia Jax versus Asuka for the title at Backlash.
I'm here for it. As someone, you know, we've been big Asuka fans on this podcast for a long time. It's just great to see her getting her due.
It is.
She's being rewarded for how good she's been in this empty arena era.
I agree, and I think Nia Jax versus Asuka will be a really good match. I mean, they've wrestled before. They can make that match work. And I'm on board actually for being a two pay-per-view series. But you know, one thing I actually was just going to mention before about Edge and Randy Orton was that, isn't it kind of weird? Sort of done it in the reverse order that they had the last man standing match at WrestleMania, and now we're having the straight wrestling match at Backlash. Weird, isn't it, that they're doing it in the wrong order?
It is strange. Edge actually responded to somebody on Instagram about that, saying that he wants to tell different stories and not have it be the same. So I am curious where they're going with it, because you've got to wonder, that you've got to assume that Randy Orton's probably going to get the win at
yes.
Backlash, and then that's going to lead us to whatever the big finale is going to be. So I hope that they... You know, if they can have a good match at Backlash and then the final one is maybe at SummerSlam in front of a crowd, then maybe the feud is salvageable.
Yeah.
But we'll see.
We will see. Yeah. Well, I mean, they're going to have the greatest match of all time at Backlash. So I mean, maybe they just need to keep wrestling for the next year or two.
I also want to give some big props again to Shayna Baszler. She beat Natalya in a submission match where she beat her in less than 4 minutes with Akita for the clutch. I actually want to, if nobody's seen it, there is a Chronicle episode on the network with Shayna Baszler, and it's excellent. It's 45 minutes long, and it covers her from the Royal Rumble to WrestleMania. It's really great, a great profile piece. But she gets the big win here, and then Natalya is basically having a fit after the match, and all the...
It was really funny, wasn't it? She's like there having a meltdown, and then all the staff come in with a carpet to set up for the Kevin Owens show, just treating her like a total jobber. I mean, there's some amusement there, wasn't there?
Poor Natalya. She tried, but Shayna Baszler clearly seems to be the one that's going to be set up for the post-Nia feud for Asuka. And yes. You know, I think Asuka and Shayna, that's a big SummerSlam match. I'm liking where it's all going. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? Natalya lost this match, and this is kind of the antithesis of Ruby Riott versus Charlotte, in that even though Natalya lost to Shayna Baszler convincingly in this submission match, and presumably that's the end of their program, afterwards she had this, you know, tantrum and starts booting the ropes. And, you know, it was really funny, Samoa Joe on commentary, like, was there, like, criticising her for the way she was conducting herself, throwing the chairs out of the ring, chucking the Kevin out of the ring. Samoa Joe's there, like, you know, browbeating, how dare she behave like this? You know, she's letting herself down, you know, it's conduct unbecoming a professional and all this. That was really amusing. But it seems like Natalya, with this meltdown, that could go somewhere for her as well. So even though she lost the match and presumably the feud, I can't imagine they're going to revisit it again. It does seem like they're going to do something different with Natalya. But yeah, as for Shayna, I mean, the only thing really was we needed another Shayna promo. We need one at least, you know. I mean, you know, after last week's stellar performance, you know, with the comments about Becky Lynch and then the comments to Natalya, we need Baszler saying something every week. We need this new mean character needs to be fleshed out. We need to hear more of this. So that's the only complaint. But I'm sure they can rectify that next week, Kenny.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, even in that Chronicle, she's great in that as well. She is a really good talker. I think it's one of her strengths, for sure. We got the Kevin Owens show, which was to talk to Angel Garza, Andrade, and Austin Theory, who have all got problems with Zelina Vega. It led to the return of Apollo Crews. I mean, it's a shame there wasn't a crowd there to go mild. And which led us to Kevin Owens and Apollo Crews against Andrade and Angel Garza. Owens and Apollo got the win when Crews hit his finisher on Angel Garza and pinned him. And that's going to lead us to Apollo Crews versus Andrade for the US title next week.
We should mention, Kenny, that the finish came after Austin Theory had accidentally drilled Garza.
It backfired.
Austin Theory's interference backfired. He hit the wrong person. Garza hits the mat. Crews pin. And then afterwards, Andrade and Garza beat the hell out of Austin Theory. And then Zelina Vega's there saying, useless. And I should never have believed in you. She said this to Theory. And then she gives him a good slap. So it's all over there. But I mean, that leads us on to something a little bit later in the show, doesn't it?
Yeah, we'll just go into that now. So then we got Aleister Black and Murphy, and obviously, you know, Austin Theory's still at ringside selling his injury, and he ends up getting involved and helping Murphy. So Seth Rollins is now going to recruit Austin Theory to his, you know, he's going to make him another...
Disciple.
And I think that the Austin Theory does fit better with Murphy and Rollins than he does with Andrade and Garza. Just because I think that, like, I don't know, Seth Rollins and Murphy are quite boring, and so is Austin Theory. So they all kind of fit together. Whereas, like, Garza and Andrade seem like absolute lads who are a great laugh. Yeah. So, you know, it's a better one.
Maybe they can call themselves the Boar Brigade, something like that.
The Boar Brigade. I thought you said the Boar Brigade. But Boar Brigade is much better. So, and then we, but my, one of my favorite parts of Raw this week was the axe throwing competition. Who knew that we needed, this is what they used to do in wrestling. They used to do these on location shoots. Last week we got the Street Profits in their kind of home turf of the basketball court, getting to sort of show up the Viking Raiders. And then this week, the Viking Raiders were showing up the Street Profits in an axe throwing contest at a, you know, Viking reenactment. But of course, as last week when the Viking Raiders proved that they actually could throw a basketball, in the end, they actually did a quite a clever thing, because Montez Ford wanted to forfeit, didn't he? He wanted to forfeit the axe throwing contest.
Yeah.
And Dawkins said, oh, no, we've got it. And then Ford kept doing it and just missing the whole time. And then Dawkins had one shot, and he did like a backwards axe throw and hit it right in the bullseye.
Bullseye, yeah.
And then the police were trying to break it up, and this female police officer was hitting on Ivar, and it was just a ton of fun. So I thought this was a real highlight of the show, and I think that the Viking Raiders are working more for me now because we're getting more character stuff.
Yeah, I mean, you know, where it's down, of course, is when they return to the ring. That's the problem, isn't it? Because, I mean, these teams are far more entertaining doing silly stuff like this than they are wrestling. I mean, I thought this was, you know, the Street Profits went to the Viking encampment to take on, you know, the Viking, not the Viking warriors or the Viking soldiers, the Viking raiders in an axe throwing contest. One might say, Kenny, that Dawkins and Ford had the full Viking experience.
I see what you did there. I see what you did. Very clever.
Now, I'm wondering, these Viking encampments, Kenny, you know, do you think they serve macaroni cheese and iron brew at places?
I think we know that if they did sell that I would have become a Viking reenactor a long time ago. But well, unfortunately, it just doesn't look like it's for me.
Nah, so, but I thought this was a, you know, barrel of laughs. I mean, they're all look like they're having a lot of fun with it. And yeah, you're right. I mean, this is the sort of stuff that they need to get these rather flat acts over. You know, and, you know, they're showing a lot more personality, and it is fun. When they get in the ring, I mean, it kind of almost feels like they're becoming pals, doesn't it? This mutual respect's building up between them. So I'm not really sure how this enhances the feud. But I mean, the truth is, I don't really care, because the feud was completely, it was a dead duck anyway before they started doing these silly things. So, I mean, these two teams are far more entertaining now than they were 3 weeks ago when they had that match on Raw, which was just never ended. So, yeah, I'm on board with this as well. It kind of, when they were doing the basketball thing and they were doing all those amazing, you know, shots, it reminded me of the old Mr. Perfect from 80, whenever it was, when they first introduced him. I mean, you'll have seen that. You wouldn't have been watching at the time, but you'll have seen that stuff retrospectively, won't you, Ken?
Yeah. He would do the basketball, and he also did, like, the football throw and all that kind of stuff. They were great, those vignettes.
Yeah, and it definitely is harking back to that. And that worked then, and obviously will work now. So, yeah, I'm not quite sure what they're going to do next week, but I would rather they did things like this and maybe just wrestle now and again. But I'm not really sure where it goes from here. You know, in many ways, Kenny, when they get in the ring, it's going to be a disappointment.
Well, speaking of disappointments, Baron Corbin was Drew McIntyre's opponent for the main event. But luckily, that wasn't really the story of the match, because earlier in the show, MVP had told Lashley, you know, if he wants to get serious, that, you know, they should get together, and Lashley ended up beating up R-Truth. And then here we saw MVP and Lashley come out and basically scout during the match. Because, you know, MVP was really good on the promo, kind of saying, you know, Corbin, you know, you put over, you retire Kurt Angle, right? And then he said this really great line where MVP said, I could spend 10 minutes listening to your accomplishments, to which I was thinking, it's a fucking spread out 10 minutes, isn't it? But anyway, and then he talks about Drew being the champion, and they were kind of there, so the whole thing was really setting up Drew beating Corbin as Lashley looked on. And I've got to say, Lashley versus McIntyre, that's the kind of feud we want to see. That feels like a main event level program. So I didn't mind that we mentioned this last week. I didn't mind the Corbin thing, because it's leading us to something else, which was the Lashley thing. So it didn't bother me. What did you make of the...
Yeah. I mean, it existed to further or set up the, you know, Lashley versus McIntyre feud. I mean, it was quite interesting earlier in the show. MVP would talk to Bobby Lashley backstage, you know, and urged him to vie for the title. He said, "I'm not trying to cause trouble between you and your wife." And then, you know, Lana made an appearance, didn't she, Kenny, backstage after this? After it appeared that MVP and Lashley were forming a pact. What was Lana's reaction?
She's just such a terrible performer. My God. Is she, like, so it's got to a point now where the instruction to her was, can you act like a petulant child? And she just threw equipment around. And look, that's fine, but like, I just think there's much better female performers who could do much more interesting things. That I'm kind of done with Lana again. Like, yeah, I'm just done. The whole screamy, shouty thing doesn't really work for me. Like, the one exception I'll ever give it is Vicky Guerrero, because she managed to make it work for her career. But like, Lana, it's just, she's trying so hard, and I just don't think it's working.
No, I don't think so. So I mean, MVP has said this then last year. Our truth, and MVP walked out and applauded Bob, and then Lana had the meltdown backstage, threw a load of tools around. I think Lana's going to be written, that'll be it for her. I just can't see her coming back after this. I don't really see a role for her. I mean, I know you never saw a role for her ever in this company, but you know, I liked
her when she was with Rusev initially. I mean, I thought when she went back with him, she was good, but I don't know. I think that the problem with Lana is that once you kind of unpack all the things that she can't do, and you show us all those things that she can't really do that well, it's very difficult to forget all that and then focus on what she can do. And that's what things happen. We've seen that she's not a very good wrestler. We've seen that she, promo-wise, ends up banging on. We've seen her in Total Divas in a... We've seen her in Total Divas in this kind of like, you know, reality version of herself, which was, you know, made you want to just jump off a cliff. So all that stuff has just made it very hard to react to the same way. The stuff that she was doing last October when she was marrying Lashley and stuff, that was fun with Rusev, but where was the payoff? The payoff would have been a Rusev and Lana match, and that's not going to happen, nor should it happen. So, I think that she... I know they see a lot of value in her. Maybe the best thing that could happen to Lana is to be let go and for her to have to figure out her strengths and go and do something somewhere else. In wrestling, I mean, like, build herself back up again.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it was tolerable, you know, and sometimes entertaining when she was posing Rusev, because we know that they genuinely are in real life married or were in the storyline. So that worked, but in any other, it doesn't really work. And we can all see that MVP is far more effective as a character, you know, even in the storyline, is like somebody who's competent, whereas Lana is seen as inept. So, I mean, it makes sense for us to encourage, or at least understand in our minds, why Lashley would want to take MVP on as an advisor rather than Lana, because he's somebody who's more likely to get results. So it just sort of seems like a natural progression for him. And as for, you know, Drew and King Corbin, obviously Drew was Lashley and MVP. They came out on the stage to watch the match. After McIntyre scored the pin with the Claymore, McIntyre's issuing a challenge to Lashley. So it's fairly obvious that that's the direction of travel, and it's going to be Lashley versus McIntyre at Backlash, which is a match that, you know, I've been talking about time. I felt like I think it can be a really good match. And again, it's the sort of match that if there was a crowd present, it would be better. But I think as things stand now, I think it's probably as good as it's going to get. So, and I think he's a guy who's credible. And when Matt beats him, which I'm sure he will, I think it will be, you know, a stature enhancer for him. So it makes more sense for me. You know, if Lashley was with Lana, for instance, and he was still continuing with that ridiculous storyline with Lana giving Lashley bad advice, then it's not really, you know, the feud is not really about between Lashley and McIntyre. It's more between Lashley and Lana, isn't it? It's kind of distracting us from what we want, which is a credible main event match between Lashley and McIntyre. So kind of Lana's, you know, a liability, really, which is probably a word that you would use to describe Lana most weeks, isn't it, Kenny?
Yes, essentially. But, you know, the sign of the fact that the WWE TV really seems to have stepped up from Money in the Bank is that, you know, usually when we talk about Raw and SmackDown, it takes us about 20 minutes to talk about both. We've been talking about both for 45 minutes now. So the sign is that the shows are getting better because there's more to talk about. There's more interesting stuff there. So I hope that continues, and I hope that it, you know, I'm glad that it's still around and we've got stuff to talk about, like you say, because, you know, the escapism is good. So we are going to be back. We're going to be back on Thursday with an overrun. Well, it's tomorrow if you're listening to this in the main feed. We'll be back tomorrow with an overrun where we will be talking about the card for Double or Nothing this weekend to just see what matches are happening there and what stands out to us. We'll be looking at an old issue of Power Slam, of course, and the usual stuff. So, Finn, have you got any plugs for us this week?
No plugs, Kenny. Have you got any plugs?
I mean, I don't need hair plugs yet, but one day I think I probably will do it at the back. I've got a double crown. But, you know, until then, patreon.com/insidetheropes is... Of course, we can get extra content, articles from Finn, bonus podcasts from us, pay-per-view reviews, retro pay-per-view reviews. Tomorrow, actually, Finn and I are going to be recording Judgment Day 2000 with Sondra, so that's going to be a very interesting pay-per-view to talk about. The Iron Man match that didn't bore us to tears, finally.
Absolutely, can't wait to review that show. Being serious, that's all, in all sincerity, that probably came across a bit sarcastic there. Get your act together, Finley, for God's sake.
No, but it's like,
seriously, no, I am looking forward to it.
Yeah, blockbuster show to talk about. So all the fun's over there, and that's what's keeping us going when there's no live events for us to promote right now. So we would really appreciate your support if you are able to. And then youtube.com/InsideTheRopes. We've got loads of interview clips up there. Interviews with Leo Rush, Aiden English. No Way Jose is an interview going up tomorrow with Lance Archer ahead of his TNT title tournament final. His Cody this weekend at Double or Nothing. So loads of content up there all the time. So Finn, I hope that you enjoy your week of DIY and watching loads of wrestling, which is essentially what it's going to be.
It is indeed, yes. Yeah, and I look forward to our next conversation, Kenny, in 2 days in real time.
2 days in real time. We will talk to you then, everybody. Bye. If I be tonight, if I'm sad tonight.